My translation. Let me see what you've done.
I passed it to him, watching him read.
How could I be otherwise? He is a prince of the blood.
And, my lord, Gaspard Trevelyan is closed-mouthed with you still, and Solane Belfort has fallen out with the Princess Lionette. We have no conduit to doings in Azal.
Delaunay looked shrewdly at me. Baudouin de Trevelyan is a lion's cub and dangerous, Phaedra, and Melisande Chara's eye standing in his shadow makes him thrice dangerous. If you would do this thing, I bid you keep your tongue sealed. A word from her and he would have your head.
He handed the translation back to me.
A nice job. Make a fair copy when you've finished, and I'll send it to the maestro. He would be interested.
The praise made me glow, but I stuck to the matter at hand. My lord, Melisande Charizai is your friend. Do you trust her so little that you think she would betray me?
To think that I asked such a question.
He leaned forward, propping an elbow on one knee and resting his chin in his hand. The lamplight caught threads of silver in his auburn hair.
Melisande plays a subtle game, and I do not know the nature of it. If ever we found ourselves at cross purposes, I would not look to our friendship for protection. Melisande knows too well how far I would go to—
He caught himself and fell silent, shaking his head.
It matters not. Heed me well when I counsel discretion, Phaedra.
Was she your lover?
Oft-times, when someone makes a stand in one place, they will cede ground elsewhere. Delaunay had taught me the trick of it, and I used it on him now. A long time ago. He grinned at me. It was of no moment, then, if he revealed it so lightly. We are well matched in many ways, but that was not one of them, unless it be that we were too well matched. If neither will give way in love, it is not pleasing in the eyes of Nama.
Delaunay shrugged, rising to his feet.
Still, I do not think either of us gave the other cause for regret, he added. Well and good. If it is your will to accede, then I shall have the contract drawn.
It is, my lord. The assignation excited me, which I did not deny. A date was set for some weeks hence, and time passed slowly. I busied myself as best I could, taking great pains with the fair copy of the Book of Scaldic Songs for Gonzago de Escabares. They were songs of battle, and I showed them to Alcuin, but he did not care for them, and I did not blame him for it. No word came for him from Vital Bouvard, and I did not speak to him of what I had overheard. Nor did I tell Delaunay. But when I made an excursion to the sanctuary of Nama with Cecily Lavaux-Perrin, I spoke of it to her, for it weighed upon my mind, and I knew she would understand. She was of the night court. You are right not to interfere, she said to me. Alcuin has pledged his service, and it is between him and Nama. If his heart is true, she will forgive. Nama is compassionate. His heart has always been true, I said, knowing it was so.
Well, then,
Cecily smiled gently, and my mind was eased. Of all people I have known, none were kinder and wiser than Cecily. So I believed then, and so I still maintain. Though it seemed it never would, at length the day of my assignation arrived, and with it came a gown, sent by Melisande's messenger, of cloth of gold. My wardrobe was quite fine by now, for Delaunay was generous in such matters, but I had never owned anything quite so exquisite as this. There was a matching caul of gold mesh strung with seed pearls. I dressed with great care, admiring myself in the mirror. Alcuin sat on the edge of my bed, watching with his grave, dark eyes.
"Be careful, Phaedra," he said softly.
"I am always careful," I retorted, meeting his gaze in the mirror. He smiled faintly.
"You were not careful with Lord Desson, and you will not be careful with Melisande. You could lose yourself in her. I have seen it, and she knows what we are."
I tucked a stray curl into the mesh. "I am for Prince Baudouin this night. You know that?
Alcuin shook his head. She will be there. It is his pleasure to have her present in the bedchamber.
I have heard it.
Melisande Charizai is the goad to Baudouin's desire. The thought of it made my heart quicken, but I took care not to show it.
I will be careful, I promised.
And then the coach arrived, and we spoke no more of it.
Alcuin accompanied me downstairs, where I presented myself for Delaunay's inspection.
Very nice, he murmured,
settling my sangroir cloak on my shoulders and pinning it for me.
A member of the House of Delaunay with a Prince of the Blood. Who would have thought it?
He smiled, but there was a reserve to his tone I didn't understand.
I shall be proud of you.
He kissed me on the brow.
Be well.
Safe in the assurance of his blessing, I went out to meet Melisande's coach, Guy trailing me like a shadow. I do not know how many properties Melisande Charizai owned, but one of them was a house in the city. I had supposed it would be close to the palace, but it was in a quiet section near the outskirts of town, a rich little gem of a house surrounded by trees. Later I learned that she had quarters in the palace itself. This was where she went when she wished to entertain in private, for her own sake as well as Prince Baudouin's. I was not sure what kind of reception to expect, but when her servants ushered us into her home, Melisande welcomed me like a guest.
"Phaedra," she said, giving me the kiss of greeting,
"I am pleased you accepted. You know my lord Prince Baudouin de Trevelyan?"
I looked past her and saw him and made a curtsy. "I am honored, my prince." He came forward and took my hands, raising me. I remembered how he had swept me into his arms at the midwinter mask.
"It is my honor to receive such a gift," he said, and looked past me to smile at Melisande. "One so touched by the hand of Elawa's companions."
Melisande returned his smile, laying a hand lightly on my shoulder. Caught between the two of them, I trembled.
"Come," she said. "We would have you play for us while we dine. Is that acceptable?"
I made myself nod. "It would be my pleasure." She turned to a servant.
"Attend to Messire Delaunay's man, and see that he is well quartered. We will adjourn to the table."
Although I was trained to it, it had been some time since I had been asked to play for a patron's pleasure. I saw clearly enough what was intended as I accompanied them. The velvet hassock and the lap harp made it plain. I sat and took up the harp, playing softly while they dined. It was strange to be welcomed as a guest, then ignored in such a manner. Servants in the black and gold Charizai livery moved smoothly and silently, serving an array of savoury dishes. Melisande and Baudouin ate and bantered in low tones as they dined, speaking as lovers will, of inconsequential things. I played, feeling very odd indeed. When they had finished and the dishes were cleared, Melisande ordered a third glass of wine poured and dismissed the servants.
"Phaedra, join us," she said, setting the glass at Baudouin's elbow. "Drink."
I set down the harp and rose obediently, coming to stand next to him. I tasted the wine, and it was very good, subtle and spicy, with an undertone of currants and rich earth.
"So you were raised at Sirius House," Baudouin mused, grey eyes beginning to gleam.
His hands encircled my waist, and he lifted me to his lap effortlessly, so smoothly my wine didn't even spill. He was a trained warrior, and strong as steel with it.
"Will you squirm with discomfort, then, like the adepts of that house, to be so treated?"
"No, my prince."
His hands were at my hips now, pressing down. Beneath layers of cloth of gold and his velvet breeches, I could feel his phallus stir against my buttocks, my breath caught in my throat.
"Phaedra is an anguissette, my prince."
Across the table Melisande's face shone by candlelight, fair and beautiful and heartless.
"If she squirms, it is not with discomfort."
"It is hard to fathom."
He ran a hand up my body to cup my breast, squeezing it.
my nipple hardened against his palm.
"But you speak the truth,"
Baudoir said to Melisande, pinching my nipple. I gasped at the bolt of pain, rocking back against him.
"And you've attired her fit for a prince."
He transferred his hand to my hair, digging his fingers into the gold mesh and drawing my head back. I felt his mouth at my bared throat, sucking at my flesh.
"Shall I have her for dessert?"
he asked, lifting his head and laughing. Melisande shrugged, sipping her wine and watching, cool and lovely.
"You have all night, my prince. This is not dessert, but only the first course. Have her here at the table, if you wish." "So I shall," he said, smiling at her, "for I've a wish to see if this desire is truly unfeigned."
And with that he rose, pushing me down across the table and lifting my skirts. With one hand at the back of my neck, he kept me effortlessly in place as he undid his breeches. My cheek was pressed hard against the white linen that covered the table. All I could see was my overturned goblet of wine and the pale red stain of wine seeping across the tablecloth as he thrust himself into me. Baudoir de Trevelyan was no green lad, and he had had years of training at Melisande Charizard's hands. If I hoped he would spend himself quickly and hasten an end to my humiliation, I hoped in vain. I closed my eyes and whimpered as he moved inside me with long, slow strokes.
"Truth again, my lady," I heard him say above me,
laughter and astonishment in his voice.
"She is hotter than Carmille's forge inside, and wetter than Aisheth's tears."
A chair scraped, and I heard Melisande rise, knew by the rustle of clothing that she had come around to stand behind him. I could hear her hands slide over the breast of his doublet, and knew that she whispered at his ear.
"Do it hard, my love," her rich voice breathed. "I want to watch you make her spend."
Tears trickled from beneath my closed lids as he laughed, obeying her order, bringing me to the brink of pleasure with fierce, hard thrusts.
"Mmm,"
Melisande's voice low with approval.
"My love, you do well."
She touched my cheek, grazing it with her fingertips, and gave the command coolly.
"Now, Phaedra."
I obeyed without volition, shuddering at the force of my climax and crying out. Baudoin laughed again and thrust once more, twice, letting himself spend.
"Ah," he said, withdrawing from me, "we should have one of these, my lady. Shall we buy one at market, do you think?"
Relieved of his weight, I straightened slowly, turning to meet Melisande's amused eyes.
"You will not find one such as Phaedra, my prince," she assured him, "and her service is pledged only to Nama and Anafiel de Launay. But come, you have tasted only the smallest part of what it is to have an adept kissed by Kushiel's dart. If you would know the full of it, the night lies at our disposal. Unless you wish to give the signal," she added wryly, addressing the last to me.
"My lady knows I do not," I said softly. I did not care how skilled a lover Baudoin de Trevelyan was. He would never hear the signal spoken from my lips. Nor, while she served his pleasure, would Melisande Charizard. If she could wait, so could I. That much I vowed to myself. Melisande laughed.
"Well then," she said, going to the far doors and flinging them open, "we shall play."
Beyond the dining hall lay a pleasure chamber. Through the door I could see it bathed in firelight, cushion-strewn, with a complete flagellary and a wooden wheel with manacles, an exact replica of the one I had seen in the halls of Valyrian House. Baudoin looked at Melisande and smiled. I thought of Hyacinth's name and bit my tongue. But if it is true that no soul is free of the touch of Kushiel's fire, it is also true that in most it is a mere smoulder. Baudoin de Trevelyan did not burn with it, without Melisande to fan the spark in him. It was her I feared, and not him. I made no protest as I was ushered into the pleasure chamber and gently stripped of my cloth of gold.
Melisande's touch was cool as she guided me onto the wheel and fastened the manacles about my wrists and ankles. Baudouin examined the flagellary, picking up a torse and fingering the slit in the center of the leather paddle.
"How is it done?" he asked, turning to Melisande and raising his eyebrows. "Do I give a scaldic war cry and charge at her?"
He hefted the torse two-handed, holding it like an axe.
"Voldemar Selig!" he shouted, then laughed.
On the wheel, I started with surprise. Melisande looked patiently at Baudouin.
"There is no how to it, my prince. You may do as you wish."
Making certain that I was secured, she tugged the wheel. It was well crafted and beautifully maintained, turning smoothly and soundlessly. The pleasure chamber and Melisande and Baudouin in it rotated in my vision. I hadn't reckoned how disorienting it would be, as the blood rushed to my head, then receded as I came right side up again. As the wheel inverted me once more, I saw Melisande select a scourge from the flagellary.
"Like this, my love," she said to Baudouin.
The world careened around me as Melisande snapped her wrist sharply, then vanished briefly in a haze of red as the weighted tips of the scourge bit at my skin. The sound like a harp string rang in my head, and I saw Kushiel's face swimming in the distance, stern and bronze. Then it faded, and there was only the dizzying vision and the ebb tide of blood in my head. Melisande replaced the scourge and nodded to Baudouin.
"As you wish," she said softly.
After that, he stepped up to it, and my flesh knew the slap of the torse, the flat wash of pain where it landed, with a thin sharp line from the slit in the middle that felt as if it split my skin every time it landed. The wheel turned, and I knew not where I was, nor where the next blow would fall. But the red haze never returned. When at last he wearied of it, he turned to Melisande, drawing her reverently over to the cushions. I was left hanging, partially inverted. Before the pressure of my own blood grew too much and consciousness left me, I saw him undo her gown and draw it off slowly, tracing its path with his lips, kneeling before her. Melisande saw me watching and smiled, and then I saw no more. I do not know how long I hung there, nor who took me down. I woke in the morning in a strange bed, and was treated like a guest by the servants when I arose. Melisande came into the dining hall as I broke my fast, looking fresh and composed.
"The couch is ready, and Delaunay's man is waiting."
She set a purse on the table near me.
"The gown is yours to keep, of course, and this is in honor of Namar."
Her blue gaze rested on me, filled with amusement.
"You are indeed a gift fit for a prince, Fedra."
"My thanks, my lady," I said automatically, taking the purse. My limbs moved stiffly today. The purse was heavy and clinked of gold. I regarded her thoughtfully. "Fit for a farewell gift, my lady? Who is saying goodbye?" The beautifully arched eyebrows rose a fraction, and Melisande inclined her head.
"Delaunay's pupil indeed," she said, and gave her liquid laugh. "I will answer, if you tell me what you know of Voldemar Selig."
I made no reply. Melisande laughed again and stooped to kiss my cheek.
"Give your Lord Delaunay my regards," she said, straightening and caressing my hair affectionately. "We will meet again, my Anguisset, and perhaps the next time there will be no prince between us."
And with that, she left. Chapter 22. You may be sure I related the exchange to Delaunay. It was never my practice to tell him everything that occurred in an assignation. There were things I had learned by then best left unsaid. He saw the marks and knew enough. Of the things which left no marks, I did not speak. But I never failed to disclose any piece of information or careless conversation which might be of interest to him. In this I was not mistaken. He frowned and paced, pondering what I had told him.
"Baudouin thought it was a scaldy war cry," he asked.
I nodded.
Did he give any sign that the words Voldemar Selig meant aught else to him?
No, I shook my head, sure of it. He spoke in jest, and meant nothing by it, but it meant somewhat to Melisande.
And he gave no sign of knowing that you were a farewell gift?
I shook my head again. No, my lord, there was no hint of it in his manner, and Melisande was careful to speak of it only when we were alone. I gazed at him, and thought of how he had brought her to see me, when de Launay's Anguissette was no more than a well-kept secret. Every artist craves an audience, my lord, and she has chosen you. Whatever is to occur, it is her desire that you know she is its architect.
De Launay gave me one of his deep, thoughtful looks. You may have the right of it, he said, but the question remains, what is to occur?
We found out in less than a week's time. It was Gaspard Trevelyan who brought the news, stunned into dismissing any thoughts of a quarrel between himself and de Launay. The clatter of many hooves rang on the paved courtyard with unmistakable urgency. I had known the Comte de Forcay since my earliest days in de Launay's household, and even during their disagreements I had never heard him so much as raise his voice. This day it echoed off the courtyard walls.
De Launay!
If anyone doubted that the household of Anarfiel de Launay was capable of moving quickly, they would have been hard put to prove it that day.
De Launay was out the door in a trice, pausing only to snatch up his seldom-used sword where it hung in his study. Guy appeared from nowhere, twin daggers in hand, shouldering two liveried servants out the door ahead of him, and Alcuin and I were but a few steps behind.
Surrounded by 10 men-at-arms, Gaspard Trevelyan sat his black horse, oblivious to our presence and the sword in de Launay's hand. His mount, lathered and blown, snorted and shifted its weight. Gaspard tightened the reins and gazed down at de Launay, a terrible look on his face.
"Isidore d'Aiglemore has just accused House Trevelyan of high treason," he said grimly.
De Launay stared and lowered his sword.
"You're joking." "No." Gaspard shook his head, his dreadful expression unchanged. "He has proof. Letters addressed to Lionette from Fauclaire of Alba."
"What?" De Launay was still staring. "How?"
"Messenger birds."
The black horse danced under him. Gaspard quieted it.
"They've been corresponding since the Cruach's visit. De Launay, my friend, what do I do? I am innocent in this matter, but I have a home and a family to think of in Forcay. The king has already sent his fastest riders to the Comte de Sommerville. He is mustering the royal army."
Behind de Launay's face, the wheels of thought began turning.
"You swear you knew nothing of it?"
Gaspard's spine stiffened in the saddle.
"My friend, you know me," he said softly. "I am as loyal as you to House Courcelle."
"There will be a trial. There will have to be a trial."
De Launay rested the tip of his sword on the paving stones and leaned on it.
"Send your 3 best men to Forcay," he said decisively. "Tell them to turn out the guard and admit no one unless they bear orders in the king's own hand. We'll draft a letter to Percy de Sommerville. There's time to intercept him before he can make the border of Azal. He knows you. He won't move against Forcay without orders from the king. It's Lionette who's at the bottom of this, and not House Trevelyan. The king won't take after your whole line."
Some of the stricken quality eased in Gaspard's expression, but not all.
"Baudouin has been implicated."
I drew in my breath sharply at his words, and Alcuin's fingers closed on my elbow. I glanced at him, and he shook his head, cautioning silence. De Launay, frowning to himself, gave no sign that he had heard it.
"You'd best come in," he said to Gaspard, "and tell me what you know. Get your men en route to Forcay. We'll devise a letter to de Sommerville, and you'll petition the king for an audience. Ganelon de la Courcelle is no fool. He will hear you."
After a moment, Gaspard nodded curtly and gave the orders to his men, tossing them a purse for the journey.
We heard the sound of their mounts' hoofbeats recede through the streets of the city. In the distance there was shouting, as the news began to break like a wave through the d'Angeline populace.
"Come in," Delaunay repeated, holding out his hand.
Gaspard Trevelyan grasped it wordlessly and dismounted. Once in the house, Delaunay ordered food and wine to be brought. I thought him mad to entertain at such a time, but once Gaspard had eaten a bite of bread and cheese and taken a long gulp of wine, he sighed and seemed to grow calmer. Since then I have seen it is true that people are reassured by the act of taking sustenance in time of great trauma. Alcuin and I hovered in the background, endeavouring to make ourselves either useful or invisible, and Delaunay made no move to send us away.
"What happened?" he asked quietly.
Over the course of the next hour, Gaspard laid out the story for us as best he knew it. He had got it from a friend who was one of the king's lords-in-waiting, so it bode fair to be accurate. Gaspard had gone directly to Delaunay with the news, not knowing where else to turn for advice, but he believed his friend had spoken truly, being concerned only for his well-being. The story he had heard was that Isidore d'Aiglemore had learned of the matter through the careless boasting of one of Baudouin's glory-seekers, deep in his cups after a fruitless patrol of Cumlach's borders. D'Aiglemore had investigated, and upon obtaining proof of it, gone straight to the king with the matter, riding day and night to reach the city in all haste. With typical Carmeline bluntness, he hadn't even bothered to request an audience, but gone directly to a public hearing and made his accusation. Lionette de Trevelyan had conspired with Fauchelet de of Alba and her son, the new Cruach, to join forces. Backed by a Pictish army, she planned to seize the regency of Terre d'Ange and place Baudouin on the throne. In exchange, she would put the forces of Azal at the disposal of Fauchelder and her son to hold the kingdom of Alba against the dispossessed heir and his allies among the Dalriada. To accomplish this, the Azalese fleet would sail directly against the master of the straits. While they had little hope of defeating him, they could perchance distract him long enough to ferry the Pictish army across the strait at its narrowest point. Once they had secured the throne, they would have the whole of the royal fleet at their disposal to achieve their return.
"It was a clever plan,"
Gaspard concluded, wiping his brow with the velveted sleeve and holding out his wine-glass for a refill.
"Dangerously clever. If d'Aiglemore hadn't proved loyal. Baudouin was his friend, after all. He might have stood to gain."
I thought of Melisande Charizai's smile and the dark glitter of the Duke d'Aiglemore's eyes behind the Jagarundi mask. I was not so sure he did not still stand to gain. Delaunay had to ask. He did it gently.
"What about Marc?"
There was no love lost between Gaspard and Lionette, but Marc de Trevelyan was his cousin and his friend. Gaspard shook his head somberly. I shadowed.
"My friend, if I could answer you truly, I would. It is in my heart to say that Marc would never do such a thing, and yet he is at odds with the king over the matter of Quintilius' fleet, and there is a question of pride at stake. He has long disapproved that Ganelon will not see his granddaughter wed, and the fate of the realm settled. If Lionette presented her plan to him all of a piece, I do not know."
"I understand," Delaunay said, and pressed the matter no further. "How did d'Aiglemore get the letters?" Gaspard gave the answer. It was one he had at the ready, and one we already knew.
"Melisande Charizai."
I opened my mouth to speak. Delaunay gave me a look, warning me not to divulge what I knew of her involvement. But I knew that well enough. It was another question that puzzled me. Baudouin was in her thrall. Why would she give him up when he stood to gain the throne?
"I would like to say it is because House Charizai is loyal," Gaspard said, and gave a short laugh, running a hand over his salt-and-pepper hair, still dishevelled from his ride. "But I think it more likely that Melisande knew full well that Lionette would never allow Baudouin to wed her. Lionette seeks a biddable daughter-in-law, preferably one who brings a formidable alliance with her. If Baudouin has not defied his mother in this yet, he would surely not do it when she had it in her power to win him the throne. Melisande Charizai is formidable in her own right, but she's no match for the Lioness of Azal.
The former rang true enough, but as for the latter, if I had not been her farewell gift to Baudouin de Trevelyan, I might even have believed it. But Melisande Charizai had known long weeks before Isidore d'Aiglemont had supposedly gained his proof. That the treachery was real, I had no doubt, nor the proof of it. But I had no doubt either that the plans for its exposure were laid with more cunning and subtlety than the treachery itself. There was naught we could do. An ambiguous word spoken carelessly to a servant of Namar was proof of nothing. Only I knew for certain what Melisande had meant by it. Delaunay, Alcuin, and I. No. We would hold our silence on this, I thought, and Melisande Charizai would gain praise for having done the right thing. And the young Duke d'Aiglemont, already a war hero, would unexpectedly rise again in prominence. Someone had said, I remembered, that all scions of Carmille thought with their swords. I did not think this one did. In the days that followed, matters fell out in accordance with Delaunay's prediction. Parliament was convened, and a high court trial summoned. While the royal army, under command of the Comte de Sommerville, swept through Azal toward Trevelyan, the king heard Gaspard's petition, and granted clemency to the estate of Forcay, provided Gaspard place himself under the aegis of the palace guard, until the trial was called to order. Nothing travels faster than gossip. A full day before de Sommerville's messenger arrived, we had learned that Trevelyan had surrendered after a short pitched battle, headed in the main by Baudouin and his glory-seekers. It was his father, Marc de Trevelyan, who had ordered the surrender. Percy de Sommerville accepted his sword, left a garrison in charge of Trevelyan, and set out for the city, with Lionette, Marc, Baudouin, and even his sister Bernadette in his custody, along with their entourage, all the principals of House Trevelyan. When they arrived at the palace, the trial began. Because Delaunay would be called to testify on behalf of Gaspard Trevelyan, for his loyalty remained in question, we were able to attend, Alcuin and I, somberly attired in Delaunay's colours. No seating was allocated for the retinues of attending nobles, but we found standing room at the sides of the hall of audience. At the far end, a great table stood. The king sat in the central seat, his granddaughter Isandre at his right hand, and flanking them were the 27 nobles of Parliament. Members of the palace guard lined the hall, and two Castellan brothers stood motionless behind the king, grey shadows in the background, only the glint of steel at their wrists betraying their presence. There are individuals who relish a spectacle, and who dote on seeing those on high brought low. Though I am not sorry to have witnessed this trial, I am not one of them, and I took no relish in the proceedings. Lionette de la Courcelle de Trevelyan was foremost among the accused, and the first brought for questioning. I had glimpsed her only once from Cecily's balcony, but I had heard tales all my life of the Lioness of Azal. She swept into the hall of audience, attired in a splendour of blue and silver brocade, the colours of House Courcelle, reminding anyone rash enough to forget it that she was sister to the king, and bearing prominently the shackles of her confinement. At the time I was surprised to see that Ganelon de la Courcelle had demanded his sister enchained. Later I learned that this dramatic touch came at Lionette's insistence, but it mattered naught. Never let it be said that the Lioness of Azal lacked for pride of her part in the scheme. She denied nothing. The evidence was brought forth. Her chin rose as she stared defiantly at her brother. He was a full 20 years her elder. She was born late, and they are long-lived, the scions of Eloa, and it was plain that neither bore each other a great deal of filial affection.
"How do you plead to these charges?" he asked her, when the matter had been laid before Parliament.
His voice strove for sternness, but nothing could hide its tremble, nor the palsy that shook his right hand, though he held it down at his side.
Lionette laughed, tossing her graying head.
"You dare ask me, brother dear? Let me charge you, and see how you plead. You cripple the realm with your lack of resolve, clinging to the ghost of your dead son in a murderous get, without even the decency to make an alliance through marriage."
Her eyes flashed dark blue, the same color as the king's. "And you dare question my loyalty?"
"I admit it. I have done as I saw fit, to secure the throne for the D'Angeline people."
The crowd murmured. Somewhere there were those who would voice approval, if only they dared. But the faces of the king and the lords and ladies of Parliament remained stern. I chanced to look at Delaunay. He stared at Lionette de Trevelyan, and his eyes burned, though I could not say why.
"Then you plead guilty,"
Ganelon de la Courcelle said softly.
"What part did your husband play in it, and your son and daughter?"
"They knew nothing," Lionette said contemptuously. "Nothing. It was my doing and mine alone."
"We shall see."
The king looked to his left and his right, his expression sad and weary.
"How will you sentence her, my lords and ladies?"
It came in a whisper, the answer, accompanied by the ancient Tiberian gesture. One by one they lifted their hands, thumbs extended, and turned them downward.
"Death," came the answer.
Isandre de la Courcelle was the last to give her vote. Cool and pale she gazed at her great-aunt, who had named her a murderous get before the peers of the realm. With slow deliberation she lifted her fist, rotated it downward. "Death."
"So be it."
The king's voice was as thin as the wind rattling the autumn leaves.
"You have 3 days to name the manner of your choosing, Lionette."
He nodded once, and the palace guard came to escort her from the hall of audience, accompanied by a priest of Eloa. She offered no struggle, and went with her head held high. And her husband, Marc de Trevelyan, was called onto the floor. The Duc de Trevelyan looked much like his kinsman, Gaspard. Older, a trifle taller and more slender, but with the same raven's wing hair streaked with grey. Lines of age and sorrow were engraved on his face. He made a gesture before the accusation was read, holding the king's gaze and lifting his empty shackled hands.
"In the writings of the Yeshuites, the sin of Azar is named as pride,"
he said quietly.
"But we are D'Angeline, and the sin of angels is the glory of our race. The sin of blessed Eloa was that he loved too well earthly things. I have sinned against you as they do, brother, in pride and love."
Ganelon de la Courcelle's voice shook.
"Do you say you aided my sister and conspired against the throne, brother?" "I say I loved her too well."
Marc de Trevelyan's gaze never wavered.
"As I love my son, who shares your blood, I knew. I did not countermand her orders to the admiral of my fleet, nor the captain of my guard. I knew."
Again the vote, again the thumbs turned downward, and it came at last to Isandre de la Courcelle. I watched her, and her face showed no more emotion than a cameo on a brooch as she turned it to her grandfather. Her voice was like cool water.
"Let him be banished," she said.
I grew up in Sirius House. I knew well how to reckon steel beneath a fragile bloom. That was the first time I saw it in Isandre de la Courcelle. It was not the last.
"What say you?"
asked the king of his parliament. None spoke, but with judicious nods their hands opened, turned palm outward. The king spoke again, his voice stronger.
"Marc de Trevelyan, for your crimes against the throne, you are banished from Terre d'Ange, and your lands are forfeit. You have 3 days to clear the border, and if you return, there shall be a bounty of 10,000 ducats on your head. Do you accept these terms?"
The once Duc de Trevelyan looked not at the king, but at his granddaughter, the Dauphine.
"You jest," he said, his voice trembling.
She made no reply. The king drew his chin into his beard.
"I make no jest."
His voice echoed in the rafters.
"Do you accept these terms?"
"Yes, my king,"
Marc de Trevelyan murmured, bowing. The palace guard closed round him.
"My lord, my daughter knew nothing. She is innocent in this matter."
"We shall see,"
the king repeated, weary again. He waved his hand without looking.
"Begone from my sight."
A whispered consultation took place at the table. They had planned to call Baudouin next, I knew. Delaunay had had it from a friend who drew up the lists. But they changed their minds and called instead Bernadette de Trevelyan, his sister. I would have known her for Baudouin's sister, for they looked much alike, but her manner was as shrinking as his was wild. It was not easy having Valioness of Arzal for a mother, I thought, if one was not the favoured cub. Within several minutes of questioning, it was obvious that she had known as much as her father, and done as little. I watched closely this time, saw the old king look to his granddaughter, saw her faint nod. The vote fell out the same. Banishment. Father and daughter would survive, albeit cut off forever from the land that nurtured us, whose glory ran in our veins like blood. I thought of Telesis de Mornay's poem and wept. Unseen in the crowd, Alcuin put his arm about me and steadied me. Baudouin de Trevelyan was summoned. Like his mother, he made the most of his chains, letting them clank as he strode into the hall. He was beautiful and magnificent in duress. A sigh echoed through the room.
"Prince Baudouin de Trevelyan," the king said aloud, "you stand accused of high treason. How do you plead to these charges?"
Baudouin tossed his hair. "I am innocent." Ganelon de la Courcelle nodded to someone I could not see. From the wings, Isidore Duc d'Aiglemort approached the floor. His face was like a mask as he inclined his head to Baudouin, then bowed to the king and gave his testimony before the High Court. Only his eyes glittered, dark and impenetrable. It was the same story Gaspard had told. A soldier's drunken boast, a loyal duke's investigation. Baudouin flushed and stared at him with hatred. I remembered that they had been friends. Isidore d'Aiglemort withdrew, and Melisande Charizay was summoned. It is so clear in my memory, that day. How much of it they knew, I am not certain, nor have I ever known. But House Charizay had come out in her support, and Melisande was surrounded by her kindred. As so often happens in the old lines, they bore the stamp of a common heritage, and the Charizay made a splash amid the hall of audience, with their blue-black hair and their long brocaded coats of black and gold. All of them had the same eyes, too, set like sapphires in pale faces. In none did Kushiel's flame burn as fiercely as it did in her, but it burned in them all, and I was grateful for Alcuin's arm. I do not think Melisande Charizay could ever manage a true semblance of modesty, but she came closer than I would have reckoned. With downcast lashes, she answered the questions of Parliament, laying out a tale of an ambitious prince in the thrall of his powerful mother, allies to be made and a throne to be won. The letters, she said, he had showed her in boast to make good on his claim. Whatever the truth of it, she spoke naught he could dispute. If Baudouin had glared his hatred at the Duc d'Aiglemort, it was nothing to the rage that purpled him as he listened to her litany. In the end, it was enough and more. With stern remorse, the nobles of Parliament voted. One by one, while Baudouin stared incredulous, their thumbs turned down. Death. It came at last to Isandre. She looked at Baudouin, unmoved as ice. "Tell me, cousin," she asked him, "would you have wed me off to a foreign potentate, or killed me outright?" He had no answer at the ready, and it was answer enough. Her hand moved, thumb pointing downward. There would be no reprieve for Baudouin. There was too much evidence. No sighs echoed the king's.
"So be it," he said,
and no one doubted that he grieved to say it.
"Baudouin de Trevelyan, you are sentenced to death. You have 3 days to name the manner of your choosing."
He did not make as good an exit as his mother. I watched him go, and his feet stumbled, disbelieving. Thus the fate of the son of too fierce a mother, whose ambition outpaced the law. Perhaps it was not so easy, I thought, to be the lioness's favorite cub. The trial of Gaspard Trevelyan went smoothly. There was no evidence and no accusation save his bloodline. I watched Delaunay give his testimony, saying how Gaspard had known naught of the plot, and brought word straight to him, heeding his advice to make a clean breast of it to the king, and I was proud to be a member of his household. In the end, Gaspard was absolved of any wrongdoing, and his title and estate affirmed in public forum. Delaunay had regained his composure. His face gave nothing away, but I marked all the while how Isandre de la Courcelle hung on his every word, and there was a hunger in her gaze I could not name. Chapter 23. In the end, the executions were held privately. It was a matter of much speculation, for the lioness of Arzal had threatened to grieve her brother through the final minute of her life by whatever means she could, and surely a public execution would have raised much ill-feeling against him. But at the last, her pride won out. She would die with dignity, and not on display for the masses. It was a swift-acting poison, I am told. She drank it straight off, and laid down to wake no more. Of Baudouin it was said that he died well. When he was told that his mother had chosen a private death, he called for his sword. The king ordered his bond struck, and his own captain of the guard to stand at second. But whatever his flaws, Baudouin de Trevelyan was a prince of the blood, and no coward. When he fell on his sword, he aimed true, the point positioned directly over his heart. The captain of the guard sheathed his blade unused. A strange and somber mood held the city in the aftermath of the trial and execution. I felt it myself. To mourn their deaths would have been to sympathize with high treason, yet mourn we did. For as long as I could remember, the lioness had ruled in Arzal, and her wild boy had been the d'Angeline's darling, the sun prince, the daring war leader. Now they were gone, and her husband and daughter wandered in exile. The shape of our world was forever changed. Even Hyacinth, by nature cynical about the fate of nobility, was touched by it. He had placed a considerable wager on the manner of death Lionette and Baudouin de Trevelyan would choose, but a morbid superstition was on him when he collected his winnings on the following day. "It is blood-cursed," he said with a shudder, holding up a silver regal. "Do you see, Phaedra? There is a shadow on it." "What will you do?" I asked. "Give it away?" "And pass on the curse?" He looked at me in shock. "Do you think I have no more scruples than that?" He shook his head, dispelling the idea. "No, I cannot use this profit for gain. I'll use it to make an offering to Azar and Elowa. Come, let's see if there are mounts to be had at the stable." The youth tending the stables that afternoon was familiar, a long-time errand boy and message runner. He left off dicing with a groom and jumped up with a grin. "Off to play the lordling about town, Hyas? Good day for it. It's quieter than Cassiel's bedchamber around here." "It'll pick up, once they set out to drown their sorrows," Hyacinth said, sounding certain of it. With a sidelong glance at me, he added in a less confident tone, "Just bring out the quietest too, will you, and fetch a lady's saddle for Phaedra no Delaunay." The lad hadn't seen me standing in Hyacinth's shadow,
but he moved with alacrity at mention of my name, which made me smile. In Knight's doorstep, the d'Angeline street folk knew better than to stand in awe of the self-styled Prince of Travellers, but Launay's Anguisette was another matter. I wore the dark brown cloak and not the sanguin, but Hyacinth took care that his friends knew who I was. It added to his prestige, and they in turn took care that I was well guarded, so both of us gained by it. Once mounted, we struck out through the city at a careful pace. In the distance behind us, I heard a skittering of hooves and a muttered curse, and turned to see if I could catch a glimpse of Guy, wondering if he had been forced to lease a mount from Hyacinth's stable. Though he was nowhere in sight, I did not doubt but that he was there. The streets were largely empty, and where people were, they stood about in small groups, talking quietly. I saw black armbands on not a few d'Angeline arms, but their bearers turned away quickly, not wanting their faces marked. "Do you grieve for him?" Hyacinth asked softly. A cart approached from the opposite direction, and I did not answer immediately. I was no more skilled a rider than Hyacinth. "Prince Baudouin?" I asked when the street was clear. Hyacinth nodded. I thought of his careless arrogance, his insulting manner, his hand at my neck pressing me against the table. And I thought of my first sight of Baudouin, bright with wine and merriment, the mask of Azar askew on his brow. He had named me Joybearer and kissed me for luck, I remembered. And 9 years later, Melisande Charizai had presented me to him with a kiss of death. I had known, and I had kept my silence. Truly I had brought him all the luck of my ill-chosen name. Yes.
I'm sorry.
He touched my arm lightly, his gaze questioning. Is it that bad? I had not told him everything, nor could I. Even now I merely shook my head. No. Never mind. Let's go on to the temple. We rode in silence for a while.
There will be other princes, he remarked presently, glancing at me. And one day, when you have made your mark, you will no longer be a Vrajna's servant, you know.
The temple of Azar beckoned in the distance, slanting beams of sunlight setting its copper dome ablaze. I cocked my head at Hyacinth. And will I then be worthy, O Prince of Travellers? Hyacinth flushed.
I didn't mean. Oh, never mind. Come on, I'll share the offering with you. I don't need charity from you, I spat at him, digging my heels into the mare's sides.
She obliged by breaking into a brief trot, which set me to bouncing ungracefully in the saddle.
We give each other what we can spare, and what we can accept, he said cheerfully, grinning as he drew alongside. And this is as it ever has been between us, Fedra. Friends?
At that I made another face, but he was right.
Friends, I agreed reluctantly, for I loved him dearly despite our quarrels. And you will share the offering by half, yes?
So it was that we came, bickering mildly, to the temple of Azar, and gave our horses into the hostler's keeping. I was not surprised to see that the temple was well attended that day. House Trevelyan was of Azar's lineage, and I had seen the black armbands. Inside the temple, hundreds of candles burned, and banks of flowers lined the walls. The priests and priestesses of Azar wore saffron tunics with a crimson chlamys, or half-cloak, fastened with bronze brooches. Each of them wore the bronze mask of Azar, individual features lost behind the mask's forbidding beauty, though none, I dare say, was so finely wrought as the one Baudouin had worn to the midwinter mask. We gave our offerings unto a priestess, who bowed and gave in turn to each of us a small bowl of incense, and we took our places in line to await our turns. I gazed at the statue of Azar upon the altar as we waited. The same face echoed in a dozen masks about us, gazed forth above the altar, proud and beautiful in its disdain. Azar held one hand open, palm upwards. In the other he held a sextant, for that was his gift to mankind, knowledge, forbidden knowledge, to navigate the world that was. Hyacinth went first, and then it was my turn. I knelt before the offering fire, and the priest at the altar sprinkled me with his aspergillum, murmuring a blessing. "If I have sinned against the science of Azar, forgive me," I whispered, tilting my bowl. Grains of incense spilled like gold into the flame, which burnt briefly with a greenish tinge. The rising smoke stung my eyes. Mindful of the line behind me, I rose and gave my bowl over to the waiting acolyte, then hurried to join Hyacinth. The temple of Eloa was quieter. No doubt people bore in mind that if Lionette and Baudouin de Trevelyan were scions of Eloa, so much the more so was House Courcelle, against whom they had committed treason. There is no roof on Eloa's temples, only pillars to mark its four quarters. Always, by tradition, the inner sanctum itself stands open beneath the heavens, unpaved, free to grow as it will. In the city's great temple, ancient oak trees flank the altar, and a profusion of growth flourishes amidst the temple grounds, flowers and weeds alike lovingly tended. By the time we arrived, it was nigh dusk, and the sky overhead was a deepening hue, the first stars emerging as pinpricks of light. Barefoot and robed in blue, a priestess met us with the kiss of greeting, and an acolyte knelt to remove our shoes, that we might walk unshod in the presence of blessed Eloa. Our offerings were taken, and scarlet anemones pressed into our hands to lay upon the altar. The statue of Eloa that stands in the great temple is one of the oldest works of d'Angeline art. By some reckoning it is crude, but I have never thought so. It is carved of marble, and vaster than the size of a man. He stands with unbound hair and an eternal smile, gaze cast down upon this world. Both hands are empty. One is extended in offering, and the other is scored with the mark of his wound, the blood he shed to mark his affinity with humankind. Birds and an occasional bat flitted about the trees as Hyacinth and I approached under the darkling sky, the advent of night leaching all colour from the scarlet anemones we bore. The earth was moist beneath my feet. Again I let Hyacinth precede me, but this time no words came as I made my offering. In the presence of Eloa, all was known, and all forgiven. I touched the fingers of the marble hand he extended, knelt and laid my blossoms at his feet. Stooping, I pressed my lips to the cool marble of Eloa's foot, and felt peace pervade me. I do not know how long I lingered, but a priest came, hands on my shoulders, bidding me to rise. He met my eyes as I did so, and his gentle smile did not falter. In his kind gaze I saw knowledge and acceptance of all that I was. "Kushiel's dot," he murmured, touching my hair, "and Nama's servant. May the blessing of Eloa be upon you, child." Though Hyacinth waited in the grove beyond, I knelt again, taking the priest's hands and kissing them in gratitude. He allowed me a moment, then drew me to my feet once more. "Love as thou wilt, and Eloa will guide your steps, no matter how long the journey. Go with his blessing." I went then, grateful for the respite, and finding my heart eased by the offering. "Thank you," I said to Hyacinth, joining him once more. He looked curiously at me.
"For what?"
"For giving what you had to spare," I said, as we reclaimed our footwear from the acolyte at the gate. I leaned over to kiss his cheek as he drew on his boots. "For being my friend."
"Patrons you can count by the score,"
Hyacinth tugged at a boot and grinned at me.
"But I reckon there are few enough can claim friendship with Delaunay's Anguissette."
It was true.
which did not stop me from slapping him on the shoulder for saying so, and thus we left as we had come, bickering, but with our hearts and our purses lighter for it. The hostler of the temple stables brought our mounts around, and we rode back toward Knight's doorstep in good spirits, making wild dashes through the alleyways in an effort to lose Guy, always unseen but omnipresent. Thus it was that we came upon the Sharizai. We emerged into the market square of Knight's doorstep. Hyacinth saw them first and checked his mount, moving without thinking, his hand sure on the reins. I drew my horse up and gazed past him. Flanked by servants bearing torches, the Sharizai rode together, gorgeous in their black and gold brocade, singing with Kusheline accents as they rode, swinging their whips and crops, bound for Mont Nuit. The women wore their hair loose, the men wore it in small braids, falling like linked curtains around their pale, gorgeous features. Darkness was full on us, and the torchlight glimmered on their blue-black hair, picking out highlights on their brocaded coats. I stared at them over the neck of Hyacinth's bay horse, picking out Melisande in their midst effortlessly. As if an unseen bolt connected us, her gaze found mine, and she raised her hand, halting their band. "Phaedra no Delaunay," she called, voice rich with amusement. "Well met. Will you come with us, then, to Valyrian House?" I would have answered, though I know not what I would have said if Hyacinth had not heeled his bay, dancing sideways between me and the Sharizai. "She is with me tonight," he said, his voice tight. Melisande laughed, and her Sharizai kin laughed with her, tall and beautiful, brothers and cousins alike. If I could not match the faces, I knew the names, all of them, from Delaunay's long teaching. Tabor, Sacrophant, Persia, Marmion, Panchon. All beautiful, but none to match her. "So you are her little friend," Melisande mused, her gaze searching Hyacinth's face. "The one they call the Prince of Travellers." "Well, and I have it on good authority you have never been beyond the city walls. Still, if I cross your palm with gold, will you tell me what will be, Tsingano?" At that the Sharizai laughed again. I saw Hyacinth's back stiffen, but his face as he replied I never saw. It mattered naught. I had heard it in his mother's voice, and I heard it in his. "This I will tell you, Star of the Evening," he said in a cold voice, bowing formally to her, the distant tone of the Dromond in his telling. "That which yields is not always weak. Choose your victories wisely." If ever I had doubted that Melisande Sharizai was dangerous, I doubted it no more that night, for alone among her kin she did not laugh and jest, but narrowed her eyes in thought.
"Something for nothing from a Tsingano? That is something indeed. Marmion, pay him, that there be no debt between us."
One name, at least, to a fair Sharizai face. A younger brother or cousin, I guessed, from the good-natured speed with which he obeyed, digging in his purse for a gold coin and tossing it in Hyacinth's direction. The coin flashed in the torchlight, and Hyacinth plucked it neatly from the air, bowing with a flourish and tucking it into his purse.
"My thanks, O Star of the Evening," he said in his normally unctuous Prince of Travellers tone.
At that Melisande did laugh.
"Your friends never fail to amuse in their honesty," she said to me.
I made no reply. Someone gave an order to the servants, and the Sharizai began to move onward, taking up their song. Melisande joined them, then wheeled her horse.
"As for Baudouin de Trevelyan, you grieve in your way," she said, her gaze making contact with mine once more, "and I in mine."
I nodded, glad of Hyacinth's presence between us. Melisande smiled briefly, then put her heels to her horse, catching up to her party with ease. Hyacinth let out his breath in a long sigh, brushing his black ringlets back. "That, if I am not mistaken, is the jewel of House Sharazar, yes?"
"You spoke the Dromant without knowing?"
My placid mare tossed her head. I glanced down and saw that my hands trembled on the reins.
"One's future knows one's name. It matters not if the teller knows," he said absently.
"That was Melisande Sharazar, wasn't it? I've heard songs about her."
"Whatever they sing, it's no more than the truth, and only a portion of it at that." I watched them disappear around a corner at the end of the street. "Stranger to tell, she knew who you were, and they sing no songs about you, Hyacinth."
His white grin flashed in the darkness. "They do, actually. Haven't you heard the one Farniel Duart wrote about the Prince of Travellers and the wealthy Countess? It's a great favourite at the Cockerel."
"But I take your meaning," he shrugged. "She is a friend of Delaunay's. Mayhap he told her. Still, it is something to so catch the interest of a prince's consort. I suppose you should be flattered."
"Her interest is first in Delaunay's intrigues," I murmured. "As for the rest, she is Kushiel's line. It is writ in her blood as surely as mine is writ in my gaze."
"That much is obvious," Hyacinth said dryly. "Only Kushielines would do their grieving at Valyrian House, and only you would be fool enough to go with them."
"I didn't."
"Nor would you,"
a third voice said behind us, flat and inflectionless in the dark. I twisted in the saddle to see Guy,